Reasonable. It's the reasonable. It's the reasonable. It's the reasonable. Coming to you every day.
Welcome back to the Reset Rebel podcast with me, Jo Yule. And today's guest is
a creative force who moves between worlds, art, fashion, counterculture, storytelling, and somehow turns all of it into something that feels both disruptive and beautifully anchored. Harris Elliott, OBE, is a multidisciplinary artist and cultural curator whose work explores identity, memory, and the poetry of space. He's built a career not simply creating images, but shaping narratives, narratives that challenge how we see beauty, culture, and even ourselves. So, Mr. Harris Elliott, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Looking forward to this.
So tell us how you managed to procure yourself the title of OBE. Let's start there.
That is a very good question. I have no idea who nominated me, but I imagine it's because of I've got a history of creating style-based but socio-political exhibitions. I've co-created a number at London Somerset House, one on a subject, Return of the Rude Boy, which was set in 2014, which looked at the Rude Boy influence over mods, skinheads and punks. I've worked with a lot of Japanese partners. I created an exhibition called Punk in Translation with some Japanese partners, which was exhibited in London. And then most recently, an exhibition where two co-creators under the heading of Bold, we created an exhibition entitled The Missing Thread, Untold Stories of Black British Fashion, which was a deep dive into the artistic responses and pedigree of different black designers who've made contributions to Britain's history, but many people weren't necessarily aware of the contributions that they made. That background of bringing people together, so different cultural demographics into different institutions and allowing other people to have a spotlight that wouldn't normally get it.
How would you describe a rude boy in your own terms?
Rude boys essentially are rebels who make choices that define how they present themselves initially, but also socio-politically, that they go against the grain of what the status quo says how you should be, but it's a sense of self, it's a sense of empowerment. Individuals who come together, unofficial collectives that have a love of style, music, politics, and a defiant sense of self.
Do you think the rude boy lives on now?
Constantly. It's an evolution. But yeah, I believe in terms of the visual or the aesthetic kind of referencing, I don't think it necessarily stays in one idiom, but I think as a spiritual referencing, that sense of purpose, definitely. It's a constantly evolving state of mind.
Has that been a kind of personal journey for you specifically?
Unofficially, in the sense that my heritage is Jamaican, and so the ideas of rude boys, I grew up with that referencing through seeing uncles or various different musics that we listen to, be that ska or reggae. So it's something that has been in the background of who I am, but maybe I'm a rebel creatively. But so in that sense, rude boy, in terms of how I think about not necessarily following a trodden path, then definitely.
How would you say your kind of familial heritage kind of influenced that path as you grew up in London?
My mum in particular was always someone who encouraged me to not follow the crowd. And so whether that was in terms of how I would dress or where we would go, she would often take me into town. We'd be looking at window displays, we'd be looking at different installations. And rather than buying gifts for me, she would treasure experience. So whether that's visiting family in Jamaica or going to America, she would always encourage me to travel. And so definitely her influence in terms of me having a global perspective definitely played a huge part in how I think about what it is that I do.
You describe your work as alchemy and turning beauty and counterculture into more of a narrative. What would you say that you're actually transforming through your work now, and why does that matter?
I think it's transforming the way that we visualize in the way that we engage with image, in the ways that we engage with culture and identity. Culture becomes, it's something that we all inhabit in various different ways, whether it's the foods that we eat or whether it's the people that we hang out with or the music. And within my world of media, often get segmented as a means of a selling tool. But the way I look at it is we never exist in any one singular vacuum. When we go about our day to day, there's different sounds, and you and I both might travel on the same train and we live in houses next door to one another. But in terms of the everyday, which we often take for granted, I try and bring the everyday or see the beauty in everyday to make that a part of the visual narratives that I weave together. So there's often a lot of familiarity in when you see the installations that I'm part of, but then the ways that I've contrasted one thing next to another, maybe it's that combination that hasn't been seen in that way before.
I mean, you move across lots of different disciplines in terms of art, fashion, curation, storytelling. Which do you see yourself first as most, perhaps an artist or more of a cultural translator?
I think it depends on how I wake up on the day as to which hat I'm wearing, but I think there's a symbiosis between all of them. So in terms of culture, is something that I live and breathe, as in through, whether it's through music, through designs, through heritage and referencing. I think how the importance of communicating new ways of seeing things is really important. I get bored quite easily. And so for me, whenever I present something, the idea is that I would need to be challenged myself by what it is that I'm working on in order to know that hopefully it would provide enough curiosity for others. So the idea of culture is really important, but then how people receive culture is equally really important. And so often within media, we find a default easy way to be able to just represent something. I just think there's so many more nuances in the way that we talk, the slang that we use, the way that people stand and hold themselves, and just gestures. It's kind of almost a visual anthropology. I love watching people. People watching is kind of something that I find really fascinating. And so it's how people operate in spaces and how we interact with one another. That's what I find really fascinating.
Where's your favourite place to go and people watch?
Probably Japan. I spend a lot of time in Japan, and so either Tokyo is brilliant, but then I also love going off-piste into more rural areas, whether it's beachside towns like Chiba or different prefectures like Nagano, which give a softer side of what we often receive as what would we seem as Japanese. But yeah, Japan's definitely one of my favourite places to go.
Need to get out there.
100% do it.
Sooner rather than later. I think it'd be very interesting, actually, to see what your opinion of the people watching actually is like in Ibiza when you come over for TEDx just like 1 week from now, which is all moving forward very, very quickly. How are you feeling about your upcoming talk?
I'd be a liar if I didn't say I wasn't a bit anxious. I'm looking forward to being with the community of the other speakers. I've only heard a few of the other speakers and their TED Talk so far, so I'm looking forward to being part of that. Looking forward to being somewhere where the sun is shining, as you said. And in terms of the talk, I just really want it to land in a way that brings something that people haven't heard before. So just aiming at that, we'll be able to do what it's supposed to.
I'm sure it will. And this is like the fourth year of the event, and it's always a joy to see it evolve, and the new community essentially of different creators and bright minds and new ideas that it brings together. So we can't wait to have you here on the island next week.
Thank you.
would you say are the main perhaps environments that have shaped your creative instinct? Was it like a formal training or more street culture or travel or community?
I studied interior architecture and design, and I always believed initially that I was going to be designing interiors for hotels, fashion retail stores. And then after graduating, I never managed to get a job directly in interiors. So that meant that I ended up making window displays for fashion boutiques, and that led me down a road of fashion styling. And so that was my background. And then in terms of what informs what I do, definitely street culture, but street culture in its broadest senses. And I love being in marketplaces. So whether that is in South London near where I live, or whether that's in, I've spent time in Serbia going to like vintage markets in Serbia, or whether it's in Jamaica where my parents are from, going to the markets there. I find markets the most powerful places that exist within culture, because it's where the honesty and the heartbeat of people who don't have an agenda outside of their means of commerce. So there's no filter, whereas in my work, where it is that you visit, there's a bit of a veneer that's created, which is there in order to be able to present something. And I just love the honesty that I find in marketplaces and the everyday people that go about their day-to-day life.
Have you ever run a market stall?
No, I've not. I mean, I've done the odd boot fair in my time. I don't think I'd be that good at it, because I'm usually too busy wanting to give stuff away rather than be selling in that way. So no, I wouldn't be the best market stall person, I'm sure.
How different do you think your life would have been if you'd been an architect and not moved into the world of fashion styling?
I don't think it would have been as fun, in all honesty. Just in the sense that there's a freedom that I have, which means that I travel loads, and it's not to say if I'd worked in architecture that wouldn't have happened, but 1 week I've just come back from Uganda and Rwanda. 2 weeks before that I was in Hamburg and then in Paris, and just the notion of where my work has taken me to various different parts of the globe, and that's because of the multifaceted ways in which my career has developed. And so I think I probably would have had a lot more money if I'd taken architecture, but I don't think I would have been as fulfilled as I am, being able to live the way that I do.
Well, yeah, I think you made the right decision there by the sounds of it. I mean, when you walk into a new space in, these different places that you're obviously traveling constantly, or for a collaboration, what are you looking for first? Is it energy, story, or more like the disruption angle?
Good question. I think it's the energy. I respond off that almost that frisson or that alchemic point when you meet someone and what it is that they're willing to offer in terms of them sharing with you the joys that they have around their city and their place. And so getting a sense of people's energy and how they see their city or their rural landscape, whichever it might be. For me, it's that spark that happens when you feel the joy that people are wanting to show you the best of what it is that they have. And so for me, that becomes a bit of a learning process, a cultural learning of you're starting to understand how different cities maneuver or how different people move. And then once you have a bit of a basic understanding of that, then it's easier to take on some of the other elements, which might be more visual narratives that exist alongside some of those things.
Where do you feel most, obviously you grew up in London, but is that the place where most of your creative focus still lies, or have you just have scattered?
It's scattered. I mean, London is a very good anchor, and I feel that all the different places that I've travelled to, there's nowhere else that has the multicultural balance, and that goes from a racial level, but also from a artistic level. There's always different theatres, different music, different gigs, different restaurants, different cafes, and other cities have them, but I've never felt it with the same breadth and combined level of community that we have in London. So from that point of view, it's an anchor. But I also, now when I visit other places, maybe it's age, I'm able to find other strengths that London doesn't have, in terms of they have different communities, but there might be different community values of how people, when you go more in the Mediterranean, how people congregate more and how families the connection of family is much more important, which, say, we don't actually have in the same way that if you're in Italy or you're in Spain, that level of how people come together and there will be a natural intergenerational connection. And so I find traveling to other places, I'm able to learn other things. And London, you grew up believing it's the epicenter, but it really isn't. It's a beautiful microcosm, but there's many beautiful things in many beautiful places.
Imagine living on a tiny island.
Actually, it's funny you should say that. I have been contemplating looking at a space in Sardinia for a while. So the idea of island getaway or kind of allowing me to think differently has definitely been something that I've been considering for the last couple of years.
Interesting. Didn't expect to hear you say that.
No, I didn't expect to either a few years ago, but it wouldn't be a fully relocate. But just in response to your previous question, I think I've realised that cities offer you one particular thing, islands and other places can offer you something else. And the one thing that I don't feel London offers, or even the UK as a whole, is really good light. And my one thing is, if I was to move away from London or have a space away from London, I'd want to be somewhere where I could have a semi-guarantee of really beautiful light, because I think that's what I miss, or I think London lacks. There's nothing that London can do about that.
Definitely not. Definitely not. It's just a location situation. But, you know, we call Ibiza the White Island, but I mean, it's basically the light island. There's just the light there at certain parts of the year. Maybe not so much in the summer because it's just a bit too saturated, but it's ridiculous. There's some days you wake up and you're just like, wow, you know, the whole world is just sparkling in a very magnificent fashion. The risk of sounding like a total cheese monkey.
But I'm envious of that because we have so much grey. So it's just that. So we started the conversation. Isn't it bright outside? It's like how it becomes such a boring British topic, but it underpins so much of how we think. But also as a creative, I think how light falls on things is really important. And so, yeah, light naturally makes things beautiful.
You can create light, I think, through, different formats, obviously through your work as well, which clearly is the reason perhaps why there are so many creative people in London and they are more inspired there, because they do need that extra external push to put something out there rather than getting that natural intake on a daily basis.
True.
But what does cultural responsibility mean to you as a curator in 2026, especially in a world right now that feels incredibly fractured?
I think my responsibility, this is a choice that I've made to kind of push my career in this direction, to be able to bring a layer of honesty and also be able to, like a prism, to be able to reflect light onto stories that don't often get told. And so knowing that responsibility exists, being able to, not just a story that I see, it might be somebody that I'm collaborating with the position that I've got, being able to try and amplify people's stories, because otherwise people's voices often get drowned out. And yes, we have the means through digital media for everyone to have a voice, but even within that, I think echo chambers get built up. And from a learning point of view, I'm always inspired when I hear something that I couldn't have been aware of before, and the beauty and the intricacies or the craft that exists within these other stories. And so, yeah, a responsibility to not just building more echo chambers, but allowing other stories to come through.
So if someone's listening and they feel other or outside the mainstream, what would you tell them about building power from that position?
Without sounding trite, for people to trust their instincts, because it's a natural, inbuilt, God-given thing that we have, this aspect. Understanding that their story has a relevance. But then I think community and collaboration is always essential. And so sometimes we might have this harebrained scheme that we want to do, but I think it's always essential that you have counterfoils or partnerships with other people where you can build things together. We're always stronger together and in numbers. So if you've got an idea and there's something you want to do, start to run with it, but then also start to test it with other people whose voices you value in order to be able to make that idea stronger. That might be they come in financially, or they come in with the ability to be able to offer space, or whatever it is they might be able to bring. But for me, one of my superpowers is being able to collaborate with people and allowing my ideas to become better because I'm working with somebody else, because they've been able to bring something that I couldn't have seen in a project. And for me, that always gives me so much more inspiration that I learn, and whatever it is we're doing can only become better than if I'd been just doing it on my own.
How easy is it to define the parameters of making those decisions as to who to collaborate with?
Oh, that is a complete utter minefield. And as much as I'm saying it, it's not easy, but I think you need to be really discerning and have a level of due diligence, and don't only work with your friends, because they're not necessarily always going to be the best collaborators. Work with people who value what it is that you do and see either an element of themselves or an element that will allow them to excel. So yeah, choosing your partners to collaborate with, I couldn't impress that point harder, that you kind of really need to have that process worked out, because sometimes you end up on long-term projects, and if those collaborators aren't as robust or aren't putting the work levels in at the same rate that you do, resentment builds. And so the right collaborators is really key.
But how do you identify, you know, I mean, it's a bit like taking an investor on board, isn't it? It's the same sort of process of, is this person long-term going to be, it's like a relationship essentially, but how do you know?
Honestly, sometimes you don't, and only time tells you. I've been in situations where you think certain people that you've known for years, you bring them on board on projects and you imagine that they have the same value system because they're saying the right words. And it's really hard because we've all got an agenda one way or another. Sometimes that agenda is altruistic, but sometimes that isn't. And so that testing process, sometimes only time tells you that. And so maybe without adding too much workloads, maybe it's worth trying out different relationships in different ways or starting small. So you start on a small project and then you get to see how does that work before you dive straight in on a massive project, and then you're halfway down the road and you're unable to pull back. So I'd say start small and then build that trust network with one another and understand what your strengths are. And then also be able to call it out, to be able to have those conversations. I didn't appreciate when that took place. And if you're not able to have objective conversations with each other, then you know very early on that this isn't going to be a partnership or a relationship that you can invest tons in.
How has technology kind of changed that whole process? I mean, you speak about visual poetry. What does that mean in a world so obsessed with speed and algorithms?
It means I'm constantly frustrated. We can't get away from the fact that we exist with digital technology. But whatever happens, it's still a choice in terms of how we use it and how we use it to benefit what we do. Whatever we use, whether it's a pen, whether it's a phone, a camera, a paintbrush, those are all tools, and it's how you use those tools. And I have used AI on certain projects, but I'm by no means a huge advocate of using it in the creative process. If anything, I will not to using it in instrumental ways, because I feel that it means that other key people that you could potentially work with end up becoming eradicated because of this aggregate that's an algorithm that's pulled something together. So I think see everything as a tool and see the conversations that you have and the ideas that you want to build as the strength. And how then do you move that forward and use digital as and when you have to. I work with Gorillaz, Jamie Hewlett and Damon Albarn, and they've just created a hand-drawn film to go alongside the new album that's being launched. And so that's a definitive choice. And yes, they're hugely successful, so they can afford the time to be able to do that. But it's the idea that we don't have... Going fast doesn't mean that you're moving forwards towards success. It just means you might reach a point quicker, but it's not necessarily going to provide the best outcome for what it is that you need.
What's it been like working with the Gorillaz, though? I love those boys.
It's always a crazy circus when I'm working with them. We've worked together for 12 years now, but there's always this beautiful relationship of trust. And so that's been built up over the years. And I worked on their 25th anniversary exhibition last year, where I turned 25 to 30 of Jamie's cartoons into fully fledged costume pieces. And so the idea of taking something 2D and making it physical, and when there wasn't a preset of what that could or should be, that's where this level or idea of alchemy came into place, because there wasn't this right way or wrong way of doing it, but it was purely based on an instinct. But I always love working with them.
Amazing. I wish I'd seen that, actually. I didn't know that was happening. I went to the Radiohead exhibition in Oxford not so long ago with the album covers. It was incredible and fascinating. And I used to work at BBC Six Music, so Gorillaz were like my favourite band at the time. And the visuals just absolutely epic. I didn't realise that you were working with those guys. So hats off.
Yeah.
I look forward to experiencing this talk when you're getting up on stage just a week from now in front of 400 plus people. How are you feeling about that part of all of this?
Gritting my teeth, but I think in the moment takes over. And so it's just remembering to trust the process, and I'm believing in the fact that you're there and you're with a community that's there to support. And whatever happens, no one else in the audience knows what you're meant to say. And so whatever you deliver will hopefully be a gift that lands in the right possible way.
Incredible.
I didn't answer how I'm feeling, but probably nervous. Waiting to answer the question.
I think it's going to be very well received, whatever the weather, however it, sticks to the script or goes completely off-piste. I think it'll be a nice tumble down the mountain for all of us to enjoy together. I'm very excited to see it in action. Thank you so much for making space in your obviously rather busy day in London to join us here on Open Lab and Thinking Cultura. It's always a pleasure to hear these incredible stories and learn something new from these cultural figures that I've been very lucky enough to speak to as part of this fourth year of this event and programming. So we will see you very, very soon. And wishing you the very best of luck with learning your speech.
Thank you. Look forward to meeting you in person.
It's the Reset Rebel. It's the Reset Rebel. It's the Reset Rebel. Coming to you every day.